Kia ora.
Kia ora. Good afternoon. Thank you very much for having me.
You are welcome. Tell me about what this venture is going to do. Is it safe to head to Tonga now? Are we in the clear zone after the volcanic explosion?
So the short answer is no, it's not safe. It is quite risky to go to Tonga right now, and there is still activity around the volcano. But what the Tungaroa is going to do is going to approach the volcano, and it's going to stay 2 kilometres away from the edge of the caldera, which is deemed to be safe for a vessel of that size. And we will leave the danger zone to this uncrewed surface vessel, the Sea Kit vessel, that's going to be mapping the crater and the volcanic vent. And because it's uncrewed, it's quite safe to sit there for quite some time. So we'll be doing the outside of the volcano and mapping where it's safe, and we're using this effectively a robot ship to do the dangerous part.
What do you do with the data that you collect?
So a lot of the data is processed on board the ship, but one of the key points of our mission and survey is it's an international collaboration, and so there's a very strong data sharing process that happens with all the data, and it gets shared across the world, and so collectively the scientific body will analyse all the different sensors and different information we collect, and then come up with, first of all, a story about what actually happened, because even though the eruption happened on 15th of January, as humans, we have no idea exactly what happened that day, let alone try to assess the risk of it happening again and the impact that would have on the ocean and the life that exists in the ocean.
Has this been done for any other volcanoes around the world? Is there any work that can hint to what you might find there, or what are the impacts that you might find?
Yeah, that's a great question. So we have analysed similar sorts of scenarios. Even in New Zealand waters, there are 3 or 4 submarine volcanoes that go north of Whakaari that have erupted, and as scientists, we have analysed those eruptions. And a lot of work has been done off Japan. Japan has a very similar situation to New Zealand and Tonga in terms of those underwater volcanoes, and in the Caribbean. So we have done this before, and we have traditionally have a fair idea of what we expect to see. But what's unique about this eruption is it was so unusual that we can't even classify the style of eruption. So in terms of what we expect to see on the seafloor and into the water column, we really haven't got a clue until we get there and actually start mapping the seafloor and actually looking at the videos. So it's going to be exciting, because potentially this is groundbreaking stuff.
Now, Kevin, you're saying that we've never seen anything like this, and this is unusual. To me, I'm thinking, well, it's a volcanic explosion. How different can they all be? Surely there are murmurs and tremors, and it was known that some eruption was afoot. What makes it so unusual?
That's, a very good question. So what confuses the science community? We had traditionally classified volcanoes based on their rock types, and certain rock types result in certain different types of eruptive behavior. So if you think of a basaltic volcano, it's like the Auckland volcanic fields. You got those little volcanoes around Auckland, Rangitoto, that are quite small and not very explosive. And then you have andesite volcanoes like Mount Ruapehu or Whakaari that produce eruptions like in 1996, or even potentially might produce one this year, that explosive clouds, but they don't do too much damage to the surrounding area. And then you have what's called rhyolitic volcanoes, which is your big volcanics like Tararua in 1886, or Rotorua, or Lake Taupo. And they're huge, very, very explosive volcanoes. But what we don't expect to see is volcanoes like andesitic volcanoes like Hungatonga, Hungahaapai, or Mount Ruapehu explode like Lake Taupo. And that's what we're seeing. We're seeing a volcano behave in a way that it's not supposed to, given its geochemistry and rock type.
Now, I don't know if this is in your brief, given that it's underwater mapping, but is usually from the ash fall and all the material that comes out from a volcanic explosion, initially it's quite toxic, but then it becomes quite nutrient-dense sort of surface for life to grow. Is that something that you will also look at under the sea?
Yeah, so there's two things that are going to happen in a volcanic eruption. The immediate effect to life is going to be absolute devastation. And this will happen through two ways, through the ash fall, which is very toxic, and especially in the air, it's very toxic to animals because it's very, especially fine glass that's very abrasive, especially to lungs. But underwater, it's toxic in terms of its trace metals and its chemicals. The second thing in this volcano that we expect to see under the ocean is something called a density current or a pyroclastic surge. And this, again, is very unique in this volcano. So these are surges of very dense volcanic material that have been blasted into the atmosphere, but then what goes up must come down. So this dense material falls down at near terminal velocity and then starts flowing along the ground or underwater at very fast speeds, very close to the ground. And these events would effectively scour out completely the seafloor of any life. So the life in the ocean has got a double-barreled effect. You've got this pyroclastic surges scouring out the seafloor, and then you have this toxic ash that falls through the water column and blankets the seafloor. Now, interestingly, straight after the eruption, the satellites in space detected an algae bloom. So what that tells us is that, yes, this ash is toxic, but at the same time, it's also providing nutrients to the ocean that has meant this algae can bloom. And, of course, algae is also and plankton is a food source to fish stocks. So on one hand, it will destroy life, but on the other hand, it could potentially also create a new food source and energy source for the existing ecosystem to perhaps recover, or potentially even a new ecosystem to come in and occupy the space that was removed from the old ecosystem.
Now, with your specialty, what are you hoping to find, or what is the data that is potential data or findings that you've got an inkling for that is most exciting you, Kevin?
Yeah, so my specialty, I am trained as a volcanologist, so I love volcanoes. Anything around the volcano is going to interest me, but my specialty is mapping the seafloor. And we actually have a very good map of what the seafloor looked like beforehand. So what we are hoping to see on this trip is the changes to that. And those changes are going to really inform science about what happened during the eruption and what mechanisms were involved with this. And one of the big questions that we have yet to answer is, where did the volcano go? Before January 14th, there was an island. And then after January 15th, the island had basically been shattered to bits, remaining, there's a couple of mini islands left. But under the sea floor, there must be tremendous damage. And so we're expecting to see literally a giant hole in the ground, a caldera or a crater on the sea floor where the island used to be. And so that's what's going to be very exciting, is trying to map the edges of that and find out how deep it really is, because that's going to tell us a lot about the mechanism that was involved and also inform us about the future risk of these volcanoes to not just Tonga, but also to especially New Zealand and Japan as well.
Yes, we're all on the Pacific Ring of Fire, aren't we, Kevin?
That's correct. And so everything we learn here has direct implications for how we assess the risk of volcanoes in many countries. And that's why this project is very exciting, because it's not a New Zealand project. It's an international project. It's been hugely funded through Japan, through the Nippon Foundation, but it's also funded through the Japanese agency JAMSTEC, which is a Japanese version of NIWA. NIWA's putting in some money, and we have the money from the UK National Environment Council. So there's lots of contributions going in, lots of scientists involved, because these are big, broad questions that impact the Pacific region, and not just the Pacific too. Don't forget the Caribbean also has some very active volcanoes, and those little islands around the Caribbean are also incredibly at risk from a similar sort of eruption.
I'm speaking with NIWA's Kevin McKay, a volcanologist who's about to board the NIWA research vessel RV Tangaroa. Can you tell us about what one must prepare for when you head off on the sea, on the ship?
So, yes. So one of the biggest issues that we have to deal with, of course, in this day and age is COVID. An outbreak of COVID on board the ship could really seriously impact how we do our operations. So we are being incredibly careful about voyage staff management, about making sure that we stay effectively in a bubble before we aboard the voyage, and we get thoroughly tested, rat tested, and saliva tested before we even board the boat. But beyond the risk that COVID presents, as we move north and get closer to the volcano, there is still a very serious risk of a volcanic eruption happening. So we have certain indications that we are trained to look for that there's activity happening. Things like, you know, is there steam rising, or are there bubbles in the water? Bubbles can indicate there's a gas discharge near the volcano. There could be discoloration around the volcano due to things like sulfur being pushed into the sea. But there's also seismographs that have been monitored by GNS at their operations centre in Wellington. They've got a global network of seismographs that they can listen to, and they can give us daily updates about what the seismic activity does. And on top of all that, one of the big precautions we do is that we have a no-go zone around the volcano that's 2 kilometres away from the caldera or the crater. We will not pass inside that. And at night time, we will retreat to within 20 kilometres outside that. The idea being that at night we can't see those signs of volcanic eruption happening. So we retreat to a place that's actually going to be safe so that we can actually sleep soundly and operate in a safe way.
Now tell me about life aboard Avi Tangaroa. Have you been on these voyages and these trips before?
Yes, I've done many trips on the Tangaroa. My longest trip on the Tangaroa has been 73 days, which is a long time. And that was a trip down to Antarctica. And you get to know your shipmates very well on those long voyages. And in actual fact, that was actually my worst voyage ever because we ran out of coffee. And can I say
no.
That we ran out of coffee?
Disaster.
I know. There were some seriously grumpy people on board that boat. So one of my first preparations I always do when I go to sea is make sure I have a plenty supply of emergency coffee just in case. But the way we operate is we run in shifts. So we work in 12-hour shifts. We work from midnight to midday for one crew, one science crew, and then midday to midnight for the second crew. So we have 24-hour operations. And so we get to know our shipmates very, very well. We have a shared meal time in the galley. And can also point out that we have two very great chefs on board that always supply us with lots of yummy food, which is not good for my waistline, I might add.
Yeah, how do you how does one exercise when they're on a voyage of 73 days?
So the Tangaroa has a gym, which is pretty amazing. It's in the bottom of the boat, right down the bottom of the very lowest deck. And it's there because that's where the motion of the vessel is least. So if you're on the running machine or the rowing machine or on the stationary bike, you're not riding a bucking bronco as the boat's bouncing up and down. So there's there's weights machines and exercises and mats and that's always quite a therapeutic place to go to. So it's not just about keeping fit, but it's also a great place to work off the stresses of the day and try to keep really motivated. But there's also plenty of viewing platforms around to enjoy the fresh air. If you're working, especially people working at night and midnight, it's really important that they get access to that daylight because it helps with their sleeping rhythms as well. It's not quite a cruise ship. It's not quite that luxurious, but it's a self-contained community, I think, is the best way to describe it.
Now, from what I can understand of what you said to me, in this voyage or in this project, as you go map the undersea, will there be any chance to be on land, or is it strictly you are on Tangaroa and you are doing your research?
Under normal circumstances, we would land in Tonga and we would pick up local Tongan observers and officials, because one of our big missions is upskilling the local communities. But because at the time we were planning it, there was restrictions on people coming to New Zealand, that meant that we couldn't bring people to the boat to start with. And in Tonga, they're still on lockdown. Anyone who lands on there has to go through a 2-week MIQ. So it's just meant it's just got too hard to land, which is unfortunate. We will pass within several kilometres of land, so we will see land, but we won't be able to touch land until we come back to Wellington in May.
Have you had a trip that long that has been strictly on the water?
All our trips. As a general rule, all our trips are like that. We just had a a fantastic trip just before Christmas. We went down to Macquarie Island, spent a month around Macquarie Island. And at some stage, we got as close as 200 meters of the shore, which is amazing because you can see the penguins, the king penguins, and the elephant seals. And it's, you just wish you could just hop on a little boat and land on the beach. But we very, very seldom touch land. These boat, the Tangaroa can go out for 90 days at a time, theoretically. The only limitation is going to be fuel and food. So it is a very rare event that we do actually land anywhere.
And how long is this trip scheduled for, Kevin?
Yes, this is going to be a reasonably short trip for us. It's only 4 weeks, 28 days. It's out of that, it's going to take us about 6 days to get to Tonga. So of that 28 days, 12 days is transit. The Tangaroa is not a fast ship. It does about 10 and a half knots. That's about 20 kilometers an hour. So we've got a lot of time on the transit up and the transit down to prepare for the science that we do. And on the way back, we've got a lot of time to actually analyze the results we get. So by the time we come back to Wellington on May the 6th, we should have some great results to share with everybody. And hopefully they're going to be very dramatic results. I'm anticipating some pretty amazing discoveries on this voyage.
And will you go back there with these kinds of volcanic explosions? Do you go back and look at it in a few years' time or in decades' time? Is this one of these projects where people return to the site, or is it this is the time to go just post the volcanic eruption?
Yeah, so this particular, because this eruption is so unique, we have to go back. And the plan is, especially for the Tangaroa, to go back possibly two or three more times. But there's also other international voyages that are also going to go back over time, simply because we just don't know what happened. But also because we don't know what happened, we don't know how the ocean environment, marine environment, is going to come back and recover. So these are just one of those classic times that we have to return many, many times. And so what we're hoping at this particular voyage is to create that baseline. We're very close to the eruption. Let's just see how the ocean is has been affected by the volcano, so that when we do return, we can start assessing, are those animals coming back and repopulating those ecosystems? Has the ocean chemistry been changed in any long-term way? What's the impact on the local fishing grounds? Because a lot of these communities in Tonga are really dependent on fishing, not just for the economy, but also for their subsistence too. So what we get and what we sample actually has a huge impact for the locals as well as the international science community.
Now, Kevin, who else is joining you on this trip? Now, you're coming in with the volcanologist lens. What other scientists from NIWA or other organisations are joining us, and what would there be some of their interests in this voyage?
Yeah, so we have 16 science staff on board. 14 of those are from NIWA. Two are from the University of Otago. So we have marine biologists that are here that specialise in what's called marine invertebrates. These are things like the corals and the crabs and the starfish that live on the seafloor. We have marine biochemists, biochemists that look at the chemistry that that marine life has, especially that the organisms, the microscopic organisms that live inside the sediment. And these organisms, they release chemicals as they live. And so we have people on board who actually look at those chemicals and assess what the respiration rate is for these communities. And actually, we have little sensors called eDNA sensors that sniff the water and detect DNA strands from all the different life that exist nearby. So we have people who specialize in eDNA. We have sedimentologists that look at the ashfall tephra in the water column, and they make assessments about the grain sizes. And if you look at the ashfall tephra, you can tell a lot about the volcanic history. Was it exploding above ground, or was it exploding underground? We have oceanographers on board, and the oceanographers are looking at the chemistry of the water, things like methane, pH, different trace metals in the water columns, different depths, and that will tell you a lot about how the water chemistry has changed. Well, who else do we have? Yeah, we've got quite a lot. Actually, one of the cool things we're deploying too, we've got staff that are deploying what's known as an ocean glider. So an ocean glider is a robot with wings and it has doesn't have an engine, but what it does is it uses gravity and wings to glide its way forward. And we're going to deploy that over the volcano, and that has a whole lot of oceanographic sensors on it as well. So that's going to tell us a lot about are there active hydrothermal systems inside the crater. What's it going to tell us about what the water temperature is in and around the volcano, what things like dissolved oxygen are. So there's a lot of people on board, and we're covering lots of different types of science. And personally, I think they're very interesting because I'm not an oceanographer, so this is a great way for me to understand what other scientists do and what their specialties are.
I see
And
lots of
collectively,
cross-disciplinary
oh,
opportunities, Kevin.
fascinating stuff. But what will happen, especially over the dinner tables, you find out saying that people are saying, oh, I'm working on this bit of science, and then someone else will say, well, that's interesting because this is very similar to what I'm doing in a different related field. How do these two different unrelated fields actually work together? So there's really good opportunities to work out, how does the geology affect the biology? How does the biology affect the chemistry? How does the chemistry affect the physical oceanography? So it's going to be a very exciting voyage.
Kevin, it sounds certainly very exciting. Hopefully we can catch up with you when you return from the voyage to Tonga. All the best for the journey. May it be smooth, and I'm very pleased to hear that you have enough coffee to last the till May the 6th.
May the 6th, that's right.
That is Kevin McKay, NIWA volcanologist.